heartbreaking that a country which has strived so hard for peace in recent years has been targeted by these terrorists. We mourn the loved ones of the victims, some of whom we can confirm were indeed U.S. citizens. This is America's fight, too. And our embassy and other parts of the U.S. government are offering all possible assistance to Americans and the Sri Lankan government alike. We urge that any evildoers be brought to justice expeditiously, and America is prepared to support that.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo addressing the terrorist attacks in Sri Lanka. More than 300 people died in a series of bombings at churches and high-end hotels. Today, the Islamic State claimed responsibility. If ISIS is indeed responsible, Sunday's attack could be its most deadly outside Iraq and Syria. And it would cast some doubt on the Trump administration's insistence that ISIS has been totally defeated. To help us understand what's going on with ISIS now, we are joined by Bruce Hoffman. He is a visiting senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's been studying terrorism for many decades now. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Madeline.
All right. What about the validity of this claim? ISIS frequently claims responsibility for attacks it has not directed. What do you make of this one?
That is true, but less so using its media arm, Amaq, and the fact that the claim that was posted on Amaq had photographs of the bombers, had them pledging their fealty or bayat to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is significant and probably lends credence to the fact that ISIS was very likely behind it.
And what does that say to you then about ISIS and its strategy now?
It shows that even though the caliphate is being defeated and the Islamic State as it was has ceased to exist, that ISIS continues to retain a capability to carry out terrorist strikes, unfortunately, on a global scale. So the ideology that fuels ISIS still resonates with individuals that are completely prepared to carry out violence in its name.
And so the Sri Lankan government has identified this other local group that I think many of us hadn't heard of, NTJ. Are they an ISIS affiliate?
Well, in fact, the junior defense minister in parliament today in Colombo, Sri Lanka, named two groups, both of whom extremely obscure. Only one is really known. I would say this is more a case which has been a long-established pattern of both ISIS and al-Qaeda of co-opting local groups, of making an alliance with them and using them to provide the local muscle, but in essence to implement a terrorist attack that was of ISIS's design. Six simultaneous or near simultaneous coordinated assaults is something emblematic of a terrorist group with considerable experience in organizational and logistical expertise.
And they've said that this is in retaliation for the attacks, the mosque attack in New Zealand. Is that valid? Is that true, do you think?
Unfortunately, it probably is credible. Very shortly after the horrific events in Christchurch last month, ISIS promised revenge and retaliation, and it would be a bit of a push to mount an attack in a month, but it's not inconceivable. If they had already established some contact with the local Sri Lankan groups and had at least partners on the ground that they could activate, you could conceive and execute an attack like this.
And so is this a war between two religions, in a sense? Is that what they're trying to foment?
ISIS has never hesitated to portray this conflict as a sectarian one, whether it's directed against Shia Muslims or Christians or Jews or anyone it regards as its enemy. And it sees particular advantage from attacking religious targets or religious shrines in heightening the terror, in heightening the worldwide opprobrium, and in focusing attention on ISIS, even when we believe that it's being defeated or eliminated, that it has this ability to rise from the dead and to carry out a highly consequential and highly lethal terrorist assault.
And tell us more about the warning that the Sri Lankan government had earlier before this attack that it was going to happen.
First, I think one has to understand that up until about a decade ago, Sri Lanka had been enmeshed in a 30-year-long civil war with its Tamil minority population. and doubtless most of the Sri Lankan government's intelligence and law enforcement assets were focused on the Tamil population and preventing a resurgence of the Tamil Tiger movement, which was defeated in 2009. So one would think that the reports they received about a hitherto obscure local terrorist or local militant organization who had been known for defacing Buddhist statues, basically acts of vandalism, may not have been accorded the seriousness that it deserved, precisely because there was either a lack of imagination or a lack of understanding or indeed of knowledge that these local groups had somehow fallen into an alliance with a far more consequential and powerful terrorist entity like ISIS.
And so I guess ISIS has not been defeated.
No, and it's interesting. The national counterterrorism strategy that the White House and National Security Council released just last October said in the first paragraph that the Islamic State and the Caliphate had been defeated, but then on page 8, I think, made the very important observation, which is proven entirely accurate, that even though the Islamic State itself has been defeated and the Caliphate dismantled, ISIS nonetheless retained at least 8 official branches and some 24 terrorist networks scattered around the world and still posed a threat. And I think this is the problem, is that historically, territory and terrorism have never been coterminous. They never really existed together. ISIS was quite unique in that respect. But what it's showing is that an ideology has a half-life or a longer life beyond even sovereignty exercised over a population or land controlled by an armed group.
Well, Bruce, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bruce Hoffman, he's at the Council on Foreign Relations. The leader of an armed militia group detaining migrants on the New Mexico-Mexico border was arrested yesterday on a weapons charge. Larry Mitchell Hopkins hasn't entered a plea yet, but today there are reports he told the FBI he was plotting to assassinate President Obama, Hillary Clinton, and George Soros back in 2017. His militia, the United Constitutional Patriots, had been detaining hundreds of migrants, they say legally, near Sunland Park, New Mexico. Well, the ACLU in New Mexico said those actions are illegal. Joining us now is Alicia Caldwell. She covers immigration for the Wall Street Journal. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Okay, well, let's talk about these reports that he was plotting to assassinate Obama and Clinton. Why was he not arrested back then in 2017?
So court documents are a little bit vague on it. There's just a mention that the FBI had information that this group and Mr. Hopkins in particular were involved in this potential plot. There's no other details. So far, the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office in New Mexico have not responded or have declined to comment. So you know what I know from reading the court document.
Okay. But he does have a very long record of interactions with law enforcement.
He does. He has a felony conviction from Michigan in the 1990s, which then precipitated an additional charge later in Oregon of being a felon in possession of a weapon, in addition to being accused and ultimately convicted of posing as a law enforcement officer in Oregon.
Okay. Yeah. And tell us more about this group, United Constitutional Patriots. What is it?
So they're a militia group, an armed group that says they're upholding the Constitution by patrolling the U.S.-Mexico border and detaining migrants. They detained a group of almost 300 last week, according to video from their own social media site. And their goal, from what I understand from their social media, is to help the Border Patrol, that they're simply overwhelmed and don't have the capacity to apprehend everybody who's coming across the border illegally.
And what does the Border Patrol say about them, if anything?
They've distanced themselves and said that law enforcement activities are reserved for law enforcement and that border security should be left to the professionals, that citizens essentially should call 911 or call the Border Patrol if they see illicit activity.
And this group says, well, we are not doing anything illegal because we can make citizens' arrests, right?
Right. They've defended their actions and said that nothing they've done is illegal. They've called Mr. Hopkins' arrest an attack, presumably by the state. They've referenced the governor of New Mexico and the state attorney general, who have both said that this activity is improper and shouldn't be conducted, and have called for investigations of the activity. So far, the FBI's role, publicly anyway, has been the arrest of Mr. Hopkins on Saturday on the weapons charge. Again, that's a charge of, because he's a convicted felon, he can't be in possession of weapons. And this all dates back to a 2017 search of his home in New Mexico, during which the FBI seized multiple weapons and ammunition and only now charged him. That's a delay that I don't have an answer to in terms of why there was a delay, but they did make the arrest a few days after this video of the detention of migrants caught quite a bit of attention.
Right. And so how did that transpire? What was the sequence of events? Who took the video and how did law enforcement find out about it?
A member of the group took the video and it was posted on Facebook. And as these things happen, it starts to catch fire, if you will. And numerous news outlets, including The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times, wrote about it. And before long, this gentleman was arrested on this charge that, again, dates to this 2017 search of his home based on an earlier tip that the organization was operating in southern New Mexico, and armed individuals were wandering around this gentleman's house and making training preparations. And then, again, the reference to the assassination attempt or plot against former President Obama, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and billionaire George Soros.
So that all happened in that 2017 search?
Correct.
The weapons.
It starts in October, and then they search in November of 2017. And fast forward to Saturday, so April of 2019, and the FBI made an arrest.
And unclear why the delay. Again.
It's unclear to me from the court records, and as I said, authorities have not said one way or the other what delayed that or what precipitated the arrest now as opposed to back in 2017. But we know that the group has come to the attention of a lot of people. It's gotten a lot of media attention in the last several days because of their activities at the border. Again, heavily armed individuals. The videos were taken by a purported member of the group who sort of narrates what's happening in one instance of this large group of migrants, the group of about 300, walking in to the United States. And you can see on the video, no one runs, no one attempts to sort of disobey what these individuals are telling them, which is, you know, they're having them sit down and wait for the Border Patrol, which agents, you know, ultimately arrive within about a few minutes of apparently some calls to the agency.
And so is there any indication that they've been doing this for a while, or was this a one-off?
They've been out there on the border apparently for about 2 months, but such groups are not new. There were a number of different organizations that formed and sort of self-deployed to the border in 2006 and 2017 during President George W. Bush's administration. They took up posts along the border at the time saying that, again, the Border Patrol was overrun and simply didn't have the capacity to fully patrol the border, so they took up positions. In that instance, most situations involved militia members calling Border Patrol, not necessarily detaining migrants the way we see now. There were, I believe, a handful of interactions directly, you know, sort of migrant and militia member, but this is obviously a little bit different. This was the detention, I guess, or corralling of about 300 people, mostly families. That's, you know, that's the largest volume of people who are crossing the border illegally right now. Their families, largely from Central America. Most say they will ask for asylum and that they're fleeing a variety of crime, poverty, and corruption.
Yeah. And so we don't know how long they were held or in what conditions?
Based on the video, it's not very long. What's generally happening at the border right now is migrants will cross the border and seek out a Border Patrol agent.
Right.
And then the Border Patrol agent or agents in the area will sort of wait for everybody to arrive, because these are large groups. large groups of 100 or more are increasingly becoming prevalent along the border from California to Texas, and they'll sort of take note of whoever everybody is and start the process while they wait for transportation, vans or buses, to then move those folks to a Border Patrol station to start the full process of identifying them and detaining them, you know, for a few days, potentially releasing them or handing them off to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. But it's unclear, you know, it didn't appear that they were there for hours and hours holding these folks, waiting for the Border Patrol. The Border Patrol appeared to arrive within a couple of minutes.
Mm. Still, there are questions about kidnapping, weapons possession, unlawful arrest.
Lots of questions,
impersonating
yes.
an officer, all of these potential crimes.
Right. And, you know, like I said, we've asked the FBI, we've asked the U.S. Attorney's Office for comment. They've either declined or not responded. And the Border Patrol has put out its statement saying, leave Border Patrol work to the Border Patrol, essentially, and feel free to call, you know, with a tip that you're seeing some sort of illicit activity. There's lots of Border Patrol agents in that particular stretch of border. It's in the El Paso sector. Sunland Park is just across the state line from Texas. It's a busy area for Border Patrol, but it's also a relatively safe area. The city of El Paso itself is quite safe, but that sector has become the second busiest for illegal crossings of families. And again, these are folks who are coming across the border and surrendering. The trend of folks coming across and running or trying to hide from Border Patrol seems to, at least for now, be gone. These are people who, as I said, are mm-hmm. seeking out Border Patrol agents.
All right. Alicia, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Alicia Caldwell. She covers immigration for The Wall Street Journal. Coming up, speaking of citizenship, we're going to find out which way the Supreme Court is leaning when it comes to allowing a citizenship question on the next census. They heard arguments today. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Supreme Court looks like it's ready to side with the Trump administration and allow a citizenship question on the next census. At least that's the takeaway from today's oral arguments. The census survey isn't usually the subject of extreme partisan fighting, but there is a lot at stake now. It dictates how many representatives each state gets in Congress, the census, and how much federal money each state gets. Robert Barnes was in the courtroom today hearing the arguments. He covers the Supreme Court for The Washington Post. Hi.
Hi.
Okay. Well, you write in your article today that the partisan divide on the court was on full display. What do you mean by that?
Well, the four liberal justices seemed very upset and skeptical that the decision to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census was just the result of wanting to, you know, have better information to enforce the Voting Rights Act, which is what Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said when he announced his decision. And they seem to think that it, you know, that there was more at stake there. They also think that it was wrong for Ross to overrule experts in the Census Bureau who said that adding that question would lead to an undercount of as many as 6.5 million people.
Mm. And then what did the other justices say?
On the other side, the five conservatives seem much more likely to defer to the administration. Congress gives a lot of power and authority in designing the census over to the agencies in charge of it. In this case, the Commerce Secretary is in charge of the Census Bureau and makes those decisions. And so the conservative justices seem to be saying, you know, is this really what the courts should be involved in? Is this really our job to be second guessing what the Commerce Secretary has decided?
So it sounds like the conservative justices weren't really willing to tackle the motivations behind it, but willing to say, well, it's not our purview. Let's just let them do it, no matter what their motivations are.
They certainly didn't seem to think the motivations were as important as the liberal justices did. And they also seemed to give, a little more credit to Secretary Ross, saying, you know, all the options were laid out for him, and this is what he decided because he is the decider in this case. The Solicitor General, Noel Francisco, said, you know, there is always a trade-off between information and accuracy, and the secretary decided this is what the decision should be, and it's his to make.
Mm-hmm. And now,
I should say it was very tense between, for instance, Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Francisco. She said that there was no doubt that there would be an undercount, that his own experts had said this, and that it was going to hurt areas, you know, with large concentrations of immigrants.
And what did the Solicitor General say to that?
Solicitor General said that there would be, you know, that there could be an undercount, that in a way that there could be follow-up to make sure that those folks return their census documents and answer the questions, and that it might be harder, but it was important information that the government should have.
But this is not information the government has had or has felt the need to have for some 70 years or so. So why does
That's
it
right.
need that information now?
Well, the last time it was asked of everyone was in 1950. People get a short form of everyone gets a short form of the census. And that question hasn't been asked until 1950, since 1950, I should say. But it has been asked in the past. Historically, it was asked, and it is asked of others up until now in the long form that some households get. And so in a way, we had a bit of a disconnect with the Solicitor General saying this is information that is always been available to the government and we have always asked, and the other side saying, no, it's not. You don't ask it of everyone. And if you do try to ask it of everyone, it's going to result in some people not giving any information at all.
Okay, and so again, the fear being that 6 million or so people will decide not to fill out the census because of this question being on it. Who are those 6 million?
Right.
They're not just undocumented.
They're not just undocumented, but they're folks that could have an undocumented person in the household and doesn't want to, give the information up. All of this information is supposed to be completely confidential and not shared with other government agencies, and there doesn't appear to be any argument that it has been shared in a way that it's not supposed to. But, you know, especially with this administration, with its hardline views on immigration, the experts think that it will be even more of a factor in the coming census because the Trump administration has made such a big deal about immigration.
So I guess the bigger question is, and maybe it's impossible to answer this, is how does one know that this question in and of itself would dissuade people from responding if there is already this culture of fear? Wouldn't they just not risk it no matter if the question was on it or not?
Right. Well, you know, that's a good question. And there was a lot, part of this debate today and this exchange of question and answers, part of it was on a very basic level. Part of it was a very technical level about, you know, statistical models and what the experts fear and feel will happen. But there does seem to be some documentation that sometimes folks will stop answering the form at the citizenship question because they are concerned, or that they don't return the document at all because it asks about it. And so there's both some studies and some anecdotal evidence that shows that this can be a factor. And again, this really isn't disputed by the administration. It's just that they think that there are some ways around it, or that the information is important enough that, you know, it's worth the risk.
Right. And again, the stakes for a state like California are pretty high, right? Because California could lose
huge
representation in Congress.
Yes, it's high for everyone in two ways. One, state by state, because the enumeration is supposed to be everyone who's in the United States, not just citizens of the United States. And that's how, you know, congressional seats are allocated. It's how hundreds of billions of dollars in federal aid is allocated. And even within the state, it makes a difference because immigrant populations tend to be centered in urban areas. And so it would mean that that urban area is undercounted. There was an interesting brief filed by the Nielsen Corporation who said that, you know, this could have an effect on, you know, its listing of what the major urban markets are. And so it has lots of sort of tentacles.
Wow. Who knew it would affect us here in radio as well? Robert Barnes,
yeah.
Supreme Court correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the first U.S. sitcom about Muslim Americans.
There's a lot of weight that gets put in on a project like this because there are just so few windows into this way of life and into this type of family.
I'll speak with the creator and star, Rami Youssef, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The title character in the new Hulu show, Rami, is in a lot of ways your typical American millennial. He works at a startup that really is not starting up at all. He uses dating apps. He still lives with his parents, but he is Muslim, and he's struggling to figure out how to live between the religious and the secular worlds. The show stars stand-up comedian Rami Youssef. It's inspired by his life, and he's here now. Hi, Rami.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. All right, so I want to talk about a scene in the first episode, which I think kind of maybe the theme of the series that you're exploring, and it's you with a girl you're dating, Chloe, and she's not Muslim, and she says something along the lines of, I thought you were culturally Muslim, not religiously Muslim.
Yeah.
And you say, well, actually, I am religious. And she's surprised by that, even though they've been dating for a little while. Can you talk about that tension between being a cultural Muslim and a religious Muslim?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the statement, I believe in God, signifies a lot of things right now. I think that there is, especially I think amongst my generation, kind of a bit of a flinchy reaction to that. And I understand it because I think that organized religion kind of as an institution or culturally has been pretty deserving of all the critique and blowback that it gets for the way things have happened. But this is a character who very much like myself spiritually identifies and feels tied to his faith and in a way that doesn't have to do with judging other people, but has to do with him wanting to connect with his higher self. And he really, you know, respects the culture and the faith that he comes from and wants it to be a part of his life. And so I think when, you know, people know you're Muslim, they kind of just want you to have like a good hummus recipe. But then if you're like, yeah, no, but I believe in God, no one wants to hear about like Allah, you know, it starts to enter a different space. And it's definitely something that people wouldn't expect from somebody who, you know, not only is of my age, but just who, you know, looks like me and lives in the world that I do and does stand up and whatnot. And while my character in the show is not a stand up comedian, you know, he shares a lot of the values that I do. And we explore those and kind of look at what does it look like to, you know, have this faith, but also, you know, still be dating Chloe, you know, and, and what is it, you know, what does it look like to have, you know, what you believe and then what you actually do? And so he's constantly questioning himself and trying to figure out where he fits in.
But do you think it's different for a Muslim to say, I believe in God, than for a Christian or for a Jew to say that?
I think anytime you're actually talking about practicing the faith when it comes to those faiths, there's a very, I think, similar reaction. I don't think that, you know, the layer of Islamophobia or any of that is so much a thing in our generation as much. It kind of tends to feel like it comes from a little bit more of the previous generation from what I've felt.
And so your character, he's really trying to figure himself out, and he comes across as a little hapless, like he wears his baseball cap backwards. So he's kind of, he doesn't seem like the most mature individual. I'm not saying like everyone who wears their baseball caps backwards is immature, but it's definitely signifies kind of a youthfulness. But there is a kind of haplessness about him. And maybe that's just, you know, a good character to have. Like, you can't have a know-it-all character, because who wants to watch that?
Yes. Well, and I think that's something that a lot of leads share in common. You know, I do think a lot of lead characters in something like this, it's important for them to be a little bit hapless and to kind of be surrounded by people who are more decided, because I think it gives you somewhere to go. And so it's very much like when I look at the separation between real life me and then fictional me, it actually, you kind of have zoned in on it. It's that haplessness, because I do think I'm a driven person and I don't sit in my problems in the same way that this character does. And this character is definitely more aloof. And I think that that, you know, gives you more to play with instead of a guy who's like charming and, you know, figures it all out and, you know.
Yeah, who can identify with that?
Eloquently state himself. And then it's kind of like, all right, well, what are we? Then it's like, okay, this guy's a psychopath. He just made a show about himself winning everything. like my character is like doing well. It's kind of like, oh God, what are we doing here?
Where's the tension? So he has a lot of tension around women and sex and what he wants. And his mom wants him to get married, of course. He decides, oh, I do want a nice Muslim woman, young woman to marry. He's just makes that decision. And then he asks his parents to set him up. Why does he do that? Why does he want his parents to find him a girlfriend or a wife?
I think he's drawn by tradition. And I think that, you know, he has seen it work out for a friend of his. You know, it's not like an arranged type thing, but I do think that there is culturally this, you know, thing of like, okay, you would get a recommendation from a friend on someone that they should maybe go on a date with. Why not get it from a family who knows the family, you know? And so this way it's like, if your intentions are to be more serious from the get-go, everyone knows, you know, when you get married to someone, you're really marrying their whole family, right? Mm-hmm. And so I've always been interested in this kind of perspective of, is it that weird to just get a recommendation from your family? Like, is it that bad? Like, and again, we're not talking about like forced arranged marriage where you, you know, lift a veil and meet someone for the first time the day of. No, we're just talking about, instead of Tinder, maybe your mom, you know, has sorted through the interests a little bit. And maybe there's someone who is cool and cute and on the same page. And yeah, maybe their parents know the parents. But I mean, that's how villages worked forever. And village culture is amazing on so many levels, and maybe not as much on others, obviously. But
has that happened to you in real life? Did you ask your mom for a recommendation in real life?
No. it hasn't. I'm like, always think it's kind of funny that like, it doesn't sound like the worst thing to me. But it, you know, timing wise, I'm not there yet, you know.
I want to play a scene from one episode. This is during Ramadan, and you're trying to talk to your family, and they're too busy not praying.
How was everyone's first day of fasting?
Alhamdulillah.
You guys want to pray Maghrib before we eat?
Please, please.
You know, I think I might go to the mosque tonight to pray Tarawih. Or read some Quran at home if anybody wants
to. Please, this is the first episode. If we miss that, we're going to be lost for the rest of the month. Please.
So he seems like he's more religious than the rest of his family. Is that right?
Well, I think it's there's just a different point of view, right? I think the parents grew up in a country where it was predominantly Muslim, and so
and this
they
is
have
Egypt,
their foundation.
Right? This is Egypt.
Yes, the in the show, the father is from Egypt, and so is the mother, but by way of being Palestinian, and they, you know, grow up in what are Muslim majority communities, and so it's in their foundation. And so it's not that they're not, you know, religious. It's just that they're not fighting for it to be a part of their identity in the way that someone in Rami's situation or generation growing up in America is. He's really trying to get it into the bedrock of his DNA, and he's kind of fighting to keep it there. While, you know, for them, it's a given, and so they're just not as active about it in the moment. But it's totally part of who they are.
So he's more insecure about it, about himself,
yes.
About trusting himself to adhere to the traditions.
Yes, yes. That's a really good way to put it.
So is that something that you have with your own family? Like, are your parents more secure with their identity than you are?
Yeah, of course. I mean, that feels very real to me. You know, I mean, I don't feel like my parents are wavering on it. It feels like a really, you know, foundational part of them. And you know, I want it, and the character wants it to be as foundational for him. But it's difficult to establish that in the same way. I mean, when you are in a Muslim majority country, there's just different things, you know, that can happen, and there's confusion there too. You know, and we highlight that, you know, in the series, because it's even like, okay, let's say I did grow up in Egypt right now. It's not like I would be any less confused potentially, you know, because a lot of it could just be a generation, it could be an era. I think these are all the things that we're trying to figure out.
Have you been to Egypt?
I go every year, yeah.
So, I mean, how do you find it now? It's gotten a lot more conservative since the Arab Spring.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot on everyone's plate there. I think the country is very much going through an identity crisis, right? The Arab Spring kind of opened up a whole new way of looking at things, and steps have been taken in a lot of different directions. But, you know, regardless of it, it's a complete reframe of what Egypt was going through, you know, structurally and politically for over 30 years. And so anytime that happens, you're just going to be thrown into an identity crisis. And so I believe that's what's happening there. Everyone's trying to figure out where they're at. I mean, even the way that, you know, elections happened, you know, we have elections here and we think it's politically divisive, but when you're at a place where, you know, for the first time, people really feel like their vote is going to count, the first time in a long time, politics becomes much more divisive than it is at a place where we get to vote every 4 years, and we have been doing that. And so it's all, you know, new on a certain level, and there are growing pains. And that's what I feel when I go there is the growing pains and the economic stresses. And, you know, we can relate on a level, but I do think that they feel it with a depth that it's just different from here. Mm.
Does the show air in Egypt?
Not legally.
Really?
not yet. Hulu's domestic, but we're in partnership with, you know, our production company on this is A24. And so We're working on getting it there, you know, because I really want to open up that conversation.
Do you think that they would react differently? The audience would react differently there than here?
Absolutely. Yeah, it'll be different. I don't know how. I can't really anticipate that. I think I could anticipate actually a lot of how the reaction would go here. It's kind of panning out in many ways that I thought it would. I especially amongst, you know, the Arab Muslim community in America, and then also the wider Muslim community in America. I think it's been really exciting to see the types of conversations that are coming up. And I would say the whole thing in general is there's a positivity about it, but there's also a ton of critique and a ton of debate over the validity of the representation, and which is why it's really important, you know, to make it clear, which I think the title does and I think the approach of the show does. But continually because we get lumped together so much, that this is really only one Muslim story, mm-hmm. you know, and it is a very specific Arab Muslim story. And because we do have at the moment so few windows, there's a lot of weight that gets put in on a project like this, because there are just so few windows into this way of life and into this type of family. And so it's been really, you know, beautiful and exciting to see how many people connect with it and connect with a lot of the specifics. And it's also, not surprising to me how many who, you know, identify with these words of being a Muslim or, you know, even being an Arab, who particularly don't. And that makes sense.
Like, what are they saying? Like, what are some of the criticisms that they're saying that you're not portraying?
Well, I think that there are different levels of adherence to the faith that people have. And so I do think that my character is very much in struggle. And I do think that there are many people who are more adherent and so want to see that, mm-hmm. you know, depiction. And so that's just kind of one of the beginnings of ways that there could be kind of a, what I believe is like a healthy discourse over something like this. But what I've been excited to portray again, you know, which I felt like I hadn't seen, which is why I wanted to make this, with someone just honestly engaging with the faith, not trying to erase it, not trying to leave it in the past, or, you know, really trying to synthesize and make it, you know, part of their life and celebrate it, even with all the complications that come with doing that.
Well, best of luck to you as the show goes forward. That's Rami Youssef. He's the lead actor and co-creator of the new Hulu show, Rami.
And season two, he might wear his hat forward, you know, just to show growth.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's going to be big. It's going to be big.
Rami, thank you so much. That was really fun.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, the guy who's giving Ken Jennings a run for his money on Jeopardy. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
This is Jeopardy.
Yes, Jeopardy, one of our favorite TV shows. Well, a professional gambler seems to be breaking that show.
You have just set a one-day record again. $131,127.
Host Alex Trebek, impressed by contestant James Holzhauer. He has racked up nearly $1 million in just 12 shows so far. He's just getting started, apparently. He's on track to beat Jeopardy's current record holder, Ken Jennings. His streak lasted 75 episodes, and he took home $2.5 million. Well, here to tell us more about Holzhauer and why he's so good at this game is Devin Ivey. She's an associate editor at Vulture. Hi.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Great to have you. Well, tell us more about this guy and what his strategy is.
Well, Holzhauer is kind of breaking the shift a bit in Jeopardy, in that usually when a viewer tunes in, they're used to this kind of a calm sportsmanship that everyone kind of quietly agrees to. You know, they start at the top with the easiest clues, get used to it, rake up a little money, and they slowly work their way down to the more difficult clues. And James is just completely shifting everything. He bets very aggressively, in a term that he likes to call strategic aggressiveness, in that he flat out goes to all of the hardest clues first, bets as much as he can if he gets the daily doubles to accrue even more money. And by the time that other contestants are able to get a say in and buzz as quickly as he can, there is just no possible way that they can catch up to him with the amount of money he makes. So he is very, very smart and strategic about just getting as much bang for his buck as he possibly can, which is very unusual strategy for Jeopardy players.
But why is it unusual? Because it is a competition. So you'd think, well, I should use the best tactics available.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually asked James that when I had the pleasure of interviewing him last week. And I asked him, you know, why is this not more common? Because it seems simpler in theory. If you want to make more money, this is exactly what you do. And he basically said, that is correct. That's a great strategy for me because I'm used to making all these bets. But for certain people, they're just simply not as comfortable starting out in certain categories. You know, when you bounce around the board, mentally it becomes a bit more of a difficult game. And some people just like that very calm, simple strategy of just descending in a straightforward way, and they don't want any more complications because naturally it's a very nerve-wracking setting to be in. And James certainly does not mind being a bit more cold-blooded, as he put it, knowing that he has the mental agility to bounce around. But some contestants just frankly aren't interested in that, and they just kind of put their best foot forward, hoping that normal strategy that works for most of the other contestants works for them. So James kind of found a way to break the mold a little bit, if you will.
Yeah, and he's also got to know a lot, right? He's got to be confident in his knowledge.
Definitely. Yeah, he claims that he goes to the library and looks through all of the children's books and gets the best intel, but I have a feeling he is just very, very intelligent on his own right, and the children's books can only take him so far.
And what about how fast he is with the little clicker thing?
He's so fast, just ungodly fast. It's so funny because you hear so many people talk about the buzzer, you know, what is this godly buzzer that everyone has to use? And you have to be just a nanosecond quicker than the rest of your contestants. And he said he was practicing, you know, he was standing up with his Dr. Scholl's like shoes and made a makeshift clicker out of a pen and tape, just to, you know, get as much practice as possible beforehand. And he just has a very good reflex of being able to click as soon as the great Alex Trebek finishes questions. It's really amazing, actually.
Is it possible to click before he finishes the question?
You know what? I have to assume no. I'm sure as soon as that last syllable of Trebek's Canadian drawl finishes, then the buzzers are allowed to go crazy. But I'm sure there's a very specific time where they could start buzzing.
Is the show worried that he's going to make too much money?
I was actually thinking that, and I have a feeling the show just really loves the amount of press and interest that this is giving them in a way, mm-hmm. because in a weird way, you know, Jeopardy epitomizes, I would say, comfort television. You kind of watch it every night, you go home. It's pretty much the same format. So when any paradigm shift happens, when a contestant comes in and kind of stirs the pot a little bit, it's just very interesting and fun to watch. So I have a feeling Jeopardy would be happy to give him as much money as possible should he continue to be so great and generate so much interest for the show. I have a feeling Wheel of Fortune is a little jealous at all the press it's getting.
Well, Jeopardy made a star of a guy named Ken Jennings. We all know Ken Jennings because he had that 75-game winning streak. Is there any talk of a Ken Jennings matchup with this guy, James Holzhauer?
Oh, that would be the dream. Has Jeopardy confirmed it? No, but Ken has talked about it. It was in a really delightful Wired interview that he did late last week, and he said, you know, I'm sure they will find a way to put me and James and all of the other greats like Austin Rogers and Buzzy Cohen, they have been two really popular players over the past few years, together in some type of tournament. You know, Jeopardy is always looking for that type of thing. Just a few months ago, they did a group tournament for the first time ever, they did a group tournament. And of course, Ken Jennings faced off against Watson about a decade ago, and that mm-hmm. was wild. So I have a feeling in a few months, whenever James finally gets defeated, the show will announce some type of great tournament of the past few decades to really have a pretty epic face-off with all the fan favorites.
Okay, and so we'll see James again tonight.
Yes.
And on, I guess.
On and on, yeah. I have a feeling he is going to go very, very far. So the question is, will he actually beat Ken Jennings, which is a great debate among Jeopardy enthusiasts naturally over the past few days, if he'll accrue that $2.5 million that Ken Jennings won. So I guess time will tell. He's on a good track, though.
And can I say immortality?
Oh, immortality. Absolutely. This guy is untouchable. I really look forward to whenever he gets defeated, what that contestant will be like in breaking this massive, massive run James has had. It's just been fascinating to watch. I can't wait to see what happens next.
Devin Ivey, Associate Editor at Vulture. Thank you.
Thank you.
Who is Michelle Alloy?
Who? She's tall. She's blonde. In her mid-30s. That's all I got. I'm not a big Jeopardy fan. I can't, like, never watched it that much. I don't know what that says about me. That's who Michelle is.
Okay. Excellent. All right.
A lot of feedback.
For 2000.
For 2000. Okay. Yeah. A lot of feedback, love, on our planned move back to Noon.
A lot of people are excited about it.
Yes.
Lots of exclamation points.
Lots of exclamation points. Wolf Cries Boy says, so happy the Mad Brand and KCRW Press Play are returning to the 12 noon time slot. I love me some Madeline at lunchtime.
Okay. Well, so that's a 12 beginning on Monday.
Monday.
Monday is the day. And then we'll have a brand new show for you at 1. So that's hosted by Radio Chio. Steve Chiotakis. That'll be great. Michelle Alloy, thank you very much. And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brandt, and I will see you tomorrow.